coming up next. Since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, the Broadbent Institute's Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, has brought left-wing thought and inquiry into public debates and policy for building a more just and equitable Canada. On this highlight from an episode of a new segment called Social Democrats of the North, host David McGrain recounts the life of Médéric Langteau, the journalist, politician, and union leader from Montreal, considered to be one of Canada's first social democrats. Now, here's the show.
Langteau and the workers that he represented saw the creation of Canada as a project of their English bosses who were just trying to line their own pockets. And Langteau and workers that he represented accused the Catholic priests and the conservative French-speaking politicians who were personally the creation of Canada as being the servants of English masters. So one of Langteau's first acts as the president of this federation was actually to denounce Confederation in favor of Quebec becoming an independent country that was separate from the rest of Canada. Hi, and welcome to episode 1 of season 1 of Social Democrats of the North, presented by the Broadbent Institute's Perspectives Journal podcast series. I'm your host, Dave McGrain, a professor of political science at St. Thomas More College at the University of Saskatchewan and member of the Perspectives Journal's editorial committee. From Confederation to the Quiet Revolution, Social Democrats of the North takes you on a journey through history to discover the lives and ideas of the leaders who shaped Canadian social democracy. Some of them you might never have heard of, and some of them might be very familiar to you. Either way, their lives will show you what social democracy has contributed to Canadian history, and their ideas will provide you with lessons that you can apply to your own activism today. Since this is a podcast on Canadian social democracy, I want to start off first with a very basic question. Who was Canada's first social democrat? Well, there is no definitive answer to this question. I want to make the case today that Canada's first social democrat was someone who was very politically active in Montreal right around 1867 when Canada became a country. I'm talking about Médéric Langteau. Langteau's origin story is really fascinating. I want to dive into that before I describe his social democratic ideas that he was talking about during the time period right around when Canada became a country. It could be said that Langteau was born into his radicalism. When he was only 1 year old, his father took up arms against the British army that was occupying Quebec in what became known as the Rebellion des Patriotes, or the Patriots' Rebellion. This took place in 1837 and 1838. Langteau's father was found guilty of high treason and sent into exile in Australia for the first years of Langteau's life. This family trauma left a deep mark on Langteau, and he grew up in the shadow of his father's exile. Throughout his childhood, Langteau was absorbing stories of resistance and stories of French-Canadian patriotism in the face of the British oppression of Quebec. These stories must have had some effect on Langteau because his rebelliousness was evident at a very young age. In 1849, he was sent to the Collège de Saint-Hyacinthe. By all accounts, he was a brilliant student, but he lacked respect for authority. He ended up being involved in a number of student pranks and was even rumored to be part of the group that attempted to burn down his own college. His teachers obviously weren't impressed, and he soon quit school and started to write articles and opinion pieces for a local newspaper. In the early 1850s, he drifted away from Saint-Hyacinthe to the big city, Montreal. When he arrived in Montreal, Langteau faced something that would end up shaping the rest of his life. He was shocked and dumbfounded to see the extreme poverty facing Montreal's working class. He saw the families of factory workers living in small rent apartments with no running water and no electricity. Through talking to these workers, Langteau found out that losing your job meant being thrown out on the street and that the children of these workers lacked basic educational opportunities. Indeed, most of the children of Montreal's working class families just assumed that they would be condemned to the same life of poverty as their parents. Given his family's radical background, Langteau was not the type of person who could sit idly by when he saw so much injustice all around him. The compassion that he felt toward the working class compelled him to want to do something to help them. He soon became a well-known journalist who was a thorn in the side of Montreal's rich elites. He was constantly writing about the horrible living conditions of the working class, and his newspaper stories embarrassed the municipal politicians who ran the city. In one act of civil disobedience, he broke the windows of a bookstore owned by the Catholic Church. This bookstore sold pamphlets outlining how the poverty of the working class is all part of God's plan and that the poor should just resign themselves to their fate. He ended up paying a $20 fine, a huge sum at the time, and was sentenced to 2 months of hard labor at prison. What makes Longteau Canada's first Social Democrats is his activities and ideas in the short time period between 1865 and 1870, right during that time that Canada was becoming a country in a process that was known at the time and is still known today as Confederation. As I mentioned, Longteau was clearly frustrated at all of the poverty that he saw around him, and he wanted to do something about it. But what was he supposed to do? There was no blueprint to follow. After all, he was Canada's first Social Democrat. It was here they became very inventive and started to do some things that no one in Canada had done before in his attempt to reduce the working class poverty that he saw all around him. He noticed that workers in Montreal were always electing conservative and liberal politicians into power, but there were never any candidates that represented workers. So, a long time before the NDP even existed, Longteau presented himself as a Labour candidate in the Montreal municipal election of 1866 in a working class district. Many workers had been impressed by Longteau's journalism that criticized Montreal's elites. And in a hard-fought campaign, he was elected by only 8 votes. However, Montreal's rich businessmen were not going to stand by and do nothing while some radical was elected to their city's municipal government. They contested his election in court, and a local judge ruled that Longteau did not have enough property to be an elected official. So his council seat was given to his opponent, who was the owner of one of Montreal's largest factories. Amazingly, Longteau did not give up in his fight to improve the living conditions of Montreal's working class. If the elites were not going to let him take his seat at City Hall, he decided that he was going to unite all of the unions in his city as a way to reduce the poverty of the working class. At the time, there were some unions in Montreal, but they were small and scattered all around the city. Longteau came up with another novel and new idea. At a mass meeting of over 5,000 workers at the beginning of 1867, Longteau proposed that all of Montreal's unions come together under one big federation of unions. He argued that by working together as one united force, the unions could bargain more effectively for better wages and better working conditions than if they stayed apart. After the meeting, the Grande Association de Protection des Ouvriers du Canada, loosely translated as the Large Association for the Protection of Workers in Canada, was formed. This was the first federation of unions in Canadian history, and Longteau becomes its first president. As president, Longteau wrote pamphlets identifying the root of the plight of the working class in his city as the factory owners, who were greedy and hoarding way more than their fair share of profits of the businesses that they owned. His solution was that government had to force capitalists to be more enlightened in their thinking and to be less greedy. So he proposed a law to force business owners to create schemes that would fairly share the profits of their businesses with their workers. Any capitalist who refused to equally share their profits with their workers would be subject to a very large financial penalty that they would have to pay to the government. So large, Longteau said, that their business would go bankrupt. Longteau's association of unions had some immediate successes in putting Longteau's ideas into action. In particular, he succeeded, along with his workers, at improving the wages at many of Montreal's bakeries. It's also important to remember that Longteau was a Francophone and that all of the workers that he represented were Francophones, but almost all the bosses of Montreal were Anglophones. This situation influenced Longteau and the workers he represented to oppose the creation of Canada, or Confederation as it was known, when it took place in 1867. Their opposition to Confederation was very much in the radical spirit of the rebellions of 1837 and 1838, the exact rebellions that forced Longteau's father into exile. Longteau and the workers that he represented saw the creation of Canada as a project of their English bosses who were just trying to line their own pockets. And Longteau and workers that he represented accused the Catholic priests and the conservative French-speaking politicians who were personally the creation of Canada as being the servants of English masters. So one of Longteau's first acts as the president of this federation was actually to denounce Confederation in favor of Quebec becoming an independent country that was separate from the rest of Canada. He argued that the interests of French-speaking workers would be routinely ignored within a larger government composed of representatives of Quebec as well as representatives of the three English-speaking colonies that were entering into Confederation in 1867, those being Ontario, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia. In this sense, Longueteau was establishing a connection between left-wing thinking and support for the greater independence of the Quebec government to protect the interests of French workers. For Longueteau, the equation was simple. To be on the side of the creation of Canada was to be on the side of the English bosses. To be on the side of an independent Quebec was to be on the side of French workers. At the end of the 1860s, Longueteau was at the height of his influence in Montreal. Not only was he president of the city's powerful Federation of Unions, he also was introducing a number of ideas to the working class in Montreal that could definitely be considered to be social democratic. Let's quickly review those ideas. Identifying the greed of business owners as the root of the poverty of workers, denouncing the Catholic priests who preached that poverty was natural and that workers had to accept the poverty into which they were born, calling on the government to make laws to force business owners to share profits fairly and equally with their workers, running labor candidates to defeat conservative and liberal politicians who cared only about serving the interests of bosses and didn't care about the poverty of the working class, creating one big federation of unions to increase the bargaining power of workers, leading to higher wages and better working conditions. And all of these social democratic ideas were wrapped up in a French-Canadian patriotism that harkened back to the rebellions of 1837 and 1838. Indeed, for Longueteau, it wasn't just workers versus bosses. It was French workers versus English bosses. He saw social democracy as a way to liberate Francophone workers from the dominance of the English, who had colonized Quebec for over 100 years by the time 1867 and Confederation had took place. In fact, Longueteau saw himself as finishing what his father had begun when he first took up arms against the English army occupying Quebec during the Rebellion des Patriotes, or the Patriots' Rebellion. Taking all of this into account, it's easy to see why the impoverished worker in Montreal at the end of the 1860s was so supportive of Longueteau and so supportive of the ideas that Longueteau was talking about. For the first time in their lives, there was finally someone who was standing up for their rights, who represented their interests, who understood their situation. However, Longueteau's success was quite short-lived. He was like a shooting star that lights up the sky in the night and then quickly fades away. The Federation of Montreal Unions that Longueteau founded disintegrated in the early 1870s due to infighting amongst its various member unions. Longueteau continued to try to be elected as a labor candidate at the municipal and federal levels in Montreal several more times, but he was always unsuccessful. He also founded a number of newspapers that espoused his social democratic ideas and critiqued the English business elites that controlled Quebec economy. But all of those newspapers went bankrupt almost as soon as they had begun. In 1872, Longueteau's career as a politician, journalist, and union leader was essentially finished. He actually gets a bit weird and desperate at this point in his life. He goes down to the United States to try to convince the French Canadians living there to lobby the American government to annex Quebec and Canada. He thought this would finally cut Quebec and Canada's tie with the British monarchy and free Quebec from the opposition of the British. But no one wanted to hear about his ideas of the United States annexing Quebec, either in the United States or in Quebec. Quite sadly, he starts to face financial ruin and poverty. He got so poor that he accepted a job as an organizer for a conservative politician in a working class area of Montreal in the 1872 federal election. The conservative politician ended up losing anyway, and Longueteau had to live with betraying his social democratic ideals for a paycheck. Following this sabbatical, Longueteau's health started to falter, and he moved to a friend's farm for some rest. He died at that farm in 1877 at the young age of 38. Despite his sad demise in the 1870s and his early death, Médéric Longueteau is an important figure in Canadian history. You have to remember that during the 1860s, it was commonly assumed that poverty was the fault of the poor. The poor were just lazy, and people thought that poverty would always really be with us because there would always be lazy people. But Longueteau thought differently, and that's why he is so important to the history of Canada. As Canada's first social democrat, Longueteau questioned this type of thinking, and he became one of the first politicians in Canada to actually care about the situation of the working class and to try to find ways to end working class poverty. So he is important because his life and his ideas laid the intellectual groundwork for future generations of reformers and radicals in Canada. He also teaches us something important for our social democratic activism today. Don't be afraid to be innovative. Longueteau probably felt quite overwhelmed and hopeless when he looked at all of the poverty facing the working class in Montreal and all the forces that lined up to keep it that way. English bosses, conservative and liberal politicians, and even the Catholic clergy. But he did not despair. He came up with innovative ideas that suited the time period that he was living in, like gathering up all of the small unions in Montreal into one big federation of unions and running Labour candidates to municipal elections. In doing so, he helped change the narratives and the discourses of Montreal politics and slowly started to reduce the poverty of Montreal's working class. He didn't succeed as much as he wanted to, and his political career was much shorter than he wanted. But others did eventually build upon what he thought and what he created. In this way, innovation is a solution for us when we as social democrats feel like the whole world is against us. And even if the innovations that we propose today seem radical and controversial, tomorrow they may become mainstream. I'm Dave McGrane, and thanks for joining me on the Social Democrats of the North, a Perspectives Journal series produced by the Broadbent Institute. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review of the Perspectives Journal podcast on your podcast platform. And share this particular podcast with someone you know who loves Canadian political history. You can also subscribe to Press Progress's award-winning Sources podcast that digs deeper into the news stories that you won't find in any major newspaper. You can read more about social democracy in the Perspectives Journal, a publication of the Broadbent Institute, by visiting perspectivesjournal.ca. Get more information about the Broadbent Institute by joining our mail list at broadbentinstitute.ca/subscribe. Come back in a couple weeks and we'll meet a social democratic leader from Ontario who started his career cracking jokes but ended up on the front lines of making political and social change at the end of the 1800s. Until then, keep questioning the status quo and stay social democratic.
There's a highlight from a new episode of the Perspectives podcast. Find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca, at broadbentinstitute.ca, and harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events, produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On the segment from a recent episode, International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group's Tim McSorley in Ottawa explains how Bill C-9 threatens the charter rights and civil liberties of Canadians, including the communities the government says it wants to protect. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, Tim McSorley of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group talks with Lorraine Chisholm about Bill C-9, the Combating Hate Act.
The federal government has introduced the Combating Hate Act with the intention to reduce hate crimes. Bill C-9 would amend the criminal code to address hate propaganda, hate crime, and access to religious and cultural places. But a human rights coalition says it threatens the charter rights and civil liberties of all people in Canada, including those communities that the government wishes to help protect. Tim McSorley is a national coordinator of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group, and Tim joins me now. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Lorraine. How are you?
I'm good, and it's always really good to talk with you.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on.
Let's dive right into your concerns about the bill. The bill creates a criminal offense of willfully promoting hatred against any identifiable group by displaying certain symbols in a public place. Now, some of us might like to see fewer hateful symbols in a public place, but what's the problem with that aspect of the act?
First of all, I have to be clear that, you know, we are concerned about how hate crimes are rising in Canada and the impact that violent hate has on communities across the country, whether it's Muslim, Jewish, or, you know, differently abled people, the 2SL LGBTQI+ community. It's a big concern for our organization, but our worry is that the government's going about this the wrong way. And the reason that we have concerns about the symbols question is primarily that there are already laws on the books that if you are promoting hatred, that you can do so by using symbols. And so we're not quite sure why, and this applies to other parts of the bill as well, but why it's necessary. But beyond that, the government has decided to link the symbols concern to the terrorist entities list by saying that a symbol could include any linked to a terrorist entity that's listed, or as well to also the Nazi swastika or the SS symbol. And our particular concern about linking it to the terrorist entities list is that for the last two decades, time and again, it's been shown that the list is a politicized, secretive, and discretionary tool that has primarily led to listing organizations that are tied to Muslim majority countries, as well as to organizations that are fighting for self-determination and against colonialism, and that the decision to link this new hate crime to a deeply flawed system risks in just expanding those problems. So, for example, only certain groups would be targeted by this new symbols listing, because, for example, the Ku Klux Klan is not a listed terrorist entity in Canada. Those displaying symbols relating to the Ku Klux Klan would not fall under these provisions at all. And so on one hand, it's narrow in scope because of its attachment to the list. But at the same time, because the list is so discretionary and problematic, it could lead to disproportionate impacts on various communities. So, for example, while far-right white supremacist organizations are some listed but not many, there's a predominant listing and many groups listed who are linked to Palestinian liberation causes. And so those groups could be targeted by this law, whereas other groups wouldn't be able to. And this isn't a matter of just expanding the list or which symbols can be included, but rather an attempt to specify which symbols are considered hateful, and to bring in a new law specifically around these kinds of symbols will constantly meet this problem. And so rather than doing so, the government should be focusing instead on existing legislation and existing powers and ensuring that they're applied properly in order to protect communities against hate.
The bill also creates broad new offenses for intimidation or obstruction. This applies to access to religious or cultural places and quite a wide range of them. What places are included and what does that mean on the ground?
Yeah, so these new provisions would essentially, as you said, create a new criminal offenses for intimidation or obstruction, specifically for places of worship, but also for a whole range of places of structures that are used by what's defined as an identifiable group for a whole range of activities ranging from administrative to sporting to educational. And so an identifiable group is defined in the criminal code. It's essentially those communities and groups that are protected from discrimination in the criminal code. So this includes racial groups, religious groups, differently abled people, discrimination based on a gender or sexual orientation. And so any structure that's used primarily by these organizations would be covered by these new provisions. And on one hand, it could appear to make sense that there will be laws against intimidating people and causing fear, because that's a key component of the new provisions, that it's intimidation with the intent of causing fear among an identifiable group from being able to use these places. But there's, again, a few problems with this. One is, again, there's already laws that exist that protect against intimidation, harassment, and obstructing the use of private places. And so we're concerned that these laws, again, are redundant. But on the other hand, a wide range of places could be considered to be used primarily by particularly religious groups. And those structures aren't always used for religious or other kinds of specified activities, but they would be still protected under this law 24 hours a day. So, for example, we know that there are times when religious institutions have been used, speaking tours by, for example, ex-Israeli Defense Force members. And there's been cases across the country of protests outside of synagogues and Jewish cultural centers that unfortunately have hosted events for the selling of land in the occupied territories in the West Bank, which is Canada has recognized as illegal under international law. And so while these institutions would be protected because of the nature of how they're primarily used, they would also be protected when they're being used for these secondary or even unrelated activities. And that raises a lot of concerns that for events that engage really political and concerning issues of public debate and public policy, that people need to be able to engage in protests and be able to voice their opinion, and that these new laws would hinder that. I think it's also really important to point out again that the way the government has described this law has been a little bit misleading. So they've spoken and said that, for example, this would also be able to protect against, you know, intimidating protests that happen outside of drag brunches, for example, and protect the queer and gender divergent community. Except that an event held at a library that's open to everybody for just an hour and a half a week, you know, when it's used for that specific event, wouldn't actually fall under this bill. as far as we understand from what the government has said. So again, on one hand, the provisions are very broad and discretionary, but on the other hand, are actually more limited in what the government has said and actually wouldn't actually address some of the real fundamental concerns that people have raised around the impacts of, you know, aggressive protests. And so, again, we think that this isn't an issue of expanding the law, but rather realizing that as you kind of add more and more layers to the criminal code, that it raises greater concerns of the police being able to use their discretion on where this applies and how it applies, and that instead it's necessary to look at what's already an offense, how can it best be applied, and how do we look at other approaches that aren't necessarily carceral in nature or police-based in nature in order to address some of these issues.
And Tim, I understand that the bill would remove the existing requirements for Attorney General approval of laying hate propaganda charges. What's the problem with that?
The reason why that exists right now is that because these are serious offenses, serious charges, and that an accusation of engaging in hate speech has the ability to seriously impact individuals' free expression rights under the Charter, that the government recognized that there needs an extra level of decision-making and approval in order to lay these kinds of charges. And so attorneys general have to give their approval. So whether it's a provincial attorney general or a federal attorney general, depending on the situation. So the government has said that the bill would remove that requirement in order to make it easier for police to lay charges and for charges to proceed to court, because that's been one of the major concerns that's been raised by groups that are impacted by and targeted by hate crimes, is that there's a delay in addressing the issue. But again, on the other hand, this has provided a significant protection to ensure that there aren't frivolous charges brought in terms of hate speech, of ensuring that when a charge is brought, that it will actually go to court and that there's a potential for conviction. So one of the concerns that we have with a lot of the parts of this bill is that it could open the door for police to lay more charges.
From Red Eye. Hear more of their high-quality public affairs and arts programming every Saturday from 10 to noon PST at CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver at harbingermedianetwork.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers. Get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. And by the Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archive episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger, and now on Blue Sky and Substack for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
This is Tim from Stereolab, and you're listening to Noise of Carpet on CJSF 90.1 and CJSF.ca.
Awesome. Thanks, Tim.
This is Bird Note. The Shinnecock people have a long and storied relationship with the wetlands and birds of what is now Long Island, says Indigenous water scientist Kelsey Leonard.
Birds are our witnesses. Their presence or absence signals whether the water, the land, are being cared for properly.
Kelsey says waterfowl hunters have helped to document that natural history. In many Indigenous hunting traditions, duck decoys are crafted to look so lifelike that they can lure free-flying ducks to wetlands where hunters lie in wait.
We at Shinnecock, we carved those out of different varietals of wood, and they represent just this broad swath of shorebirds, waterfowl, different types of ducks. We have some of those still in the cultural material record that are over 100 years old.
Some of these Shinnecock decoys depict species that are no longer found on Long Island.
These carvings, they're not just artifacts. They're a testimony to that relationship and how one individual had to have such a unique relationship with that bird to understand how to draw with such meticulous care that they confused and deceived other birds. And that is very important for how we document a loss of biodiversity and a loss in relationship to climate change.
Learn more about indigenous science and practices in the latest season of Bring Birds Back, available in your favorite podcast app. For BirdNote, I'm Joanice Franklin.